everybody. It is Katie Kessner. I am the primary host of the Dear Katie podcast, and we are so delighted to have you take this journey with us on our weekly podcast episodes. I just want to remind everyone to do great self-care. Thriving is part of the purpose of this podcast, and we definitely want you to take a break at any time, warm bath, fresh air, walk a dog, have a bite of chocolate, whatever you need to do good care for yourself. Just as a reintroduction, if you're not familiar with me, I am the woman who was on the cover of Time magazine at age 18 as the first in history to speak out nationally and publicly as the victim of date rape. And HBO made a film about me, and I went on to become the executive director of the Take Back the Night Foundation. We are the oldest, largest global movement on sexual violence in all forms for all people in the world. So we encourage you to visit our website for lots more information. So I'm going to turn it over to our host and our guest for today. Welcome to the Dear Katie podcast. Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast for those of you who have joined us for many an episode. We are simply delighted to welcome Maeve to our podium, our microphone, our platform today, and you'll learn all about Maeve and her story. But first, I ask Claire to make sure we do good self-care.
Yes, thanks, Katie. This is Claire Kaplan. Sometimes our discussions on the podcast can be a little difficult, hard to hear perhaps, or it brings up difficult memories for folks, especially survivors of trauma. So we encourage you to please take care of yourselves. Take care of your safety and well-being. So if necessary, reach out for emotional support from family or friends, a counselor, or even a hotline. You can find additional resources on the Take Back the Night Foundation website. I'll give you that address at the end of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Claire. And again, we are so delighted to have with us Maeve. Maeve, we always like to start out with a little bit of your bio, where you're from, where you grew up. Tell us a little bit about the history of Maeve.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland with just my parents and my grandparents. I'm an only child. I currently go to Dickinson College. I'm in my last semester actually here. Before I graduate and I go off to grad school, I'm interested in becoming a nutritionist. So that's on the horizon. But other than that, I love to run. And I've been really lucky my whole life to have just really wonderful people supporting me. So that's just a little bit about me.
Do you like to run long distance or fast or hurdles or like trail run? Like,
fitness?
A runner myself. So like, what do you like?
Oh, long distance. The longer, the better. I just did actually a 200-mile relay in Oregon. I do it every year. I'm getting into the ultra running community. It's great. I love it. Yeah.
You know, I have a good friend who does ultra marathons, and he is just, always, I think he loves to think and run. You can really process a lot of things while your body is in motion and you're just looking at the beautiful outdoors. So perhaps we can talk a little bit more about the ultra. So it's 200 miles. You said how many? What did you just say? 200?
It's a 200-mile relay. It's a team of 12 people. So I'm not running the whole 200, but
it's 12 people?
Yeah. So we each run three legs of the race. I think the funnest part is you get to run at night. And it's a blast. Honestly, it's wonderful.
So 212 people, and you divide it into chunks of thirds, like 12, and then you do another section, so, and you do it again?
Basically, you do each leg of the race is a different length and a different difficulty. And so depending on your fitness level, you can choose to do a length that suits your needs. I happen to run a lot, so I tend to do the harder ones. I like the challenge. And so, for me, I might end up running almost a marathon length, but someone else might be running 15 miles total by the end of the race.
And is it accomplished in 24 hours, or how long does it take? It must take longer than that. It must.
It depends on the team. The team that I run with is some older people. And so we tend to do it in about 28 to 30 hours, which is pretty good. They're amazing.
Sounds
runners.
Great.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. Well, we'll come back to that, but maybe I think that started off on a really powerful, positive start, because if anything, I hope our listeners are always learning how many different ways there are to have hobbies, interests that invigorate, inspire, and heal us. So thank you for starting with that, babe. So you're a sophomore, I think, at Dickinson, or a junior now?
I'm actually a senior.
Oh, you're a senior, almost done. Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic. So then the story that brings you to your microphone and your survivorship, let's delve into that. Like, tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So last February, I downloaded Tinder. And I did that because I was coming out of a long-term relationship. I was in a relationship with someone actually for 3 years. And it was really complicated. And I realized that I owed it to myself to try and meet new people, and not necessarily to delve into a longer relationship again, but just because I needed to build back that self-worth and that trust in others, and especially in men. And so I downloaded Tinder. I was really new to that, to the dating scene in general. And I matched with this guy. He was older than me. He was 25. And I decided to meet him, and I didn't really want to, which is the odd thing. It was more of like I felt like I should, because I didn't want to let him down, which is something I think that comes from not being very experienced at dating, recognizing when you can say no, when you can say this is too much for me. But I had agreed to go on a date with him, and in my head that looked like going to my favorite coffee shop to get coffee. And that's what we agreed on. And I get a text, and he says he's driving back from up north and he's too tired to go to the coffee shop. So can he just bring me coffee instead? And that was the first red flag that I chose to ignore. And I'm a people pleaser. And I said, sure, if it's easier for you, absolutely. Bring the coffee here. I think I even offered to pay for the coffee. And he shows up, and I have this feeling in my gut. And my goodness, no one should ever ignore their gut. I'm not a superstitious person. I just never, ever ignore my gut. And I did this day. And he shows up, and I walk outside to meet him. It's freezing. And I see him, and I immediately know that I've made a mistake.
Wait. That's a huge thing. That was huge, Maeve. Tell me more. Like, let's hold stop on that. Well, tell me what were the signs and symptoms.
I saw him, and it was in his body language. It was the way he was looking at me. His eyes went up and down my body, and I remember that feeling. I remember the feeling of being undressed before I'd been undressed. And I remember the feeling of knowing that there was a door to my dorm that I could close in his face and never see him again, but the guilt that came with wanting to be kind, you know, and failing in that. And I feel like there's this layers and layers of feeling like you're failing people, maybe especially as a woman. And he wouldn't make eye contact with me. And that was a big deal. And I thought to myself, this is odd, but I'm going to give it a chance. Because I had never done this before. I thought, well, maybe he's nervous. He's really tall. He's 6'4". He's a big guy. And I'm 5 feet tall. And it was a little intimidating. But I just decided I'm going to give it a chance, because after all, we're just getting coffee. And that's also when I realized he wasn't holding any coffee. And at this point, we'd already walked inside because it was so frigid. And when I was walking up to my room because it felt like the only direction to go. I didn't really know what I was doing, and I didn't really know how to tell this person who had told me that he'd just driven at least 3 hours to see me on his way, it turns out, back home to another place in Pennsylvania. But in my head, I was like, oh, he drove all this way. I have to live up to his expectations, even if that means sacrificing my own. And he comes in my room and he sits on my bed. And my bed is sacred to me, you know, as I think it is to everyone. People don't just sit on your bed without asking. And I sat on my bed as well, and we talked and talked. And somehow he managed to basically lay me down on the bed. And at first I thought it was just kind of like a cute cuddling thing, but it made me a little uncomfortable. But then he started to kiss me. And I asked him to stop because I didn't want that. But he just laughed and he kept going. And I actually texted my roommate and I said, can you come back to the room?
Can I stop you for a minute?
Uh-huh.
How did you text your roommate while this was happening?
I had my phone with me. I always have my phone with me if I'm going to have someone in the room who I don't know super well, very close to me. And we have a code word, my roommate and I. And I had my phone basically in my hand, and I'm laying on the bed, and he's kind of doing this supposedly cute, cuddly thing and trying to kiss me. And I'm just like, wait, my roommate texted me. I just need to quickly respond. And I kind of made that excuse. And I text her and I say, I'm uncomfortable. Can you make an excuse to come back? Basically, can you call me and say, Maeve, I have a problem. I need to come back to the room right now. Something to interrupt this process. And she did just that. And I said, thank you. You know, sure enough, come back. Room's all yours. And so she says she's coming back. And I thought that phone call would make it clear to him that whatever he wanted wasn't going to happen, so he could leave. And instead, that incentivized him to pick up the pace. And before I knew it, I have this most vivid memory of realizing that he took his clothes off, that he took his pants off. And I have no idea when that happened. And he raped me. And I remember laying there and thinking, I can yell, I can scream, and something terrible happens, something much worse can happen. Or I can just be quiet and I can just to go somewhere deep in my mind, escape, and do my healing later. And I chose the second option because I was so scared. And it's interesting because when I reflect on that, I don't remember the pain of him. I remember him spitting on me. And that feeling of a disregard for whatever body I have was so useless and disgusting to him that he would spit on it. And my roommate did come back, and she got back too late, and she knew something horrible had happened because at that point he was leaving. He didn't seem to care. He seemed to think everything was fine. I was laying there shaking. My shirt was still on. In fact, I'm wearing the same outfit I wore that day right now because the first thing I did after that day was reclaim it because it happened to be my favorite outfit and I was not going to let him take that from me. And she opens the door. And she comes in and he's walking out and he can't make eye contact with her. And she looks at me and she says, what happened? And I say, I think something horrible happened. And she, who's actually trained at a local rape crisis center, didn't even need me to explain. She came over to me. She hugged me. She was calm and collected. And she moved away from me to look at my eyes, and she looks down at her hand, and I'm sorry, this is a little graphic, but his ejaculate was on her hand because it was also apparently all over my back He did not use a condom. So that led to a lot of, you know, seeking health care afterwards as well. And she just held me, the most incredible person I've ever met. And after that, I didn't cry. I took a shower, a very hot shower. I threw my clothes in the wash. I took my computer and I walked to my favorite coffee shop. I ran into another really good friend of mine there. And I said, I think something horrible just happened to me. And I just sat with him and he didn't ask questions because I think it was obvious to him I couldn't answer any questions. And I just wrote a paper. and that is pretty much the story from start to finish.
Wow. There is so much in that story. And thank you for being so descriptive. I think that sometimes it's hard for people to do that. But also the way you handled yourself and the way you're so aware of why you made certain choices, what was going through your mind, how your roommate supported you, the fact that you were able to talk about it right away. Pretty amazing.
Thank you.
It really is. I want to stay in that time right now, and then we can go into some stuff that's after that. But when you said you took a shower, so the idea of going to the hospital and doing the whole evidence thing wasn't a priority for you, I assume, at that point, or something you were considering.
It's interesting. Unfortunately, this is not the first time that this has happened to me, though it's the most cruel and the most violent. And I knew what I, quote unquote, should do if I wanted to pursue legal action. But from the moment it happened, I knew that I didn't have it in me to pursue that. That after just recovering from some past trauma, that what I needed to do was get as far away from this trauma as possible. Or if I could, claim that trauma as my own and make it my own power. And I remember standing in the bathroom actually and turning on the water and thinking, if you do this, this is evidence. And I realized that I didn't want my body to be evidence. And that was a choice that I made. And I felt like, in some ways, for me, that was reclaiming the consent that I hadn't given. So in taking that shower, I was choosing one path that for me led to healing that I don't believe I would have been capable of if I had pursued it legally.
Okay. Well, then you had obviously thought it through pretty thoroughly. And I think that's a choice a lot of survivors make. So you scrubbed yourself down, you went out, you had coffee, you met your friend, and you said, kind of described a bit of what happened. And I'm wondering, you were still, I assume, were you kind of in a state of shock still at that point?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I actually still have not cried about it. I kind of feel like I'm in some ways still in a state of shock when I realized that this actually happened. But at the time, absolutely, I was in shock. And I just needed to keep moving my body forward in whatever direction that was, towards a coffee shop, towards the library, wherever. I just needed to keep moving and I needed to get out of my dorm.
Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense. Can you describe for us, as the days proceeded after that, how your body felt or how the feelings, you know, did some feelings come back? How did you negotiate that?
Yeah.
Or did you stay kind of numb for a while?
So I definitely was numb. But I did the following day go to our wellness center because I realized I needed to see a practitioner because I wouldn't stop bleeding. Mm. And I bled for a week after that. What made it real for me wasn't reflecting on the event itself, but it was entering that office, going into that room, having the most caring nurse look at my body and say that she could visually see the trauma that had happened to it because there were lacerations in my vagina. And she gave me some shots that I needed to just prevent any potential STIs, as well as I was actually put on antibiotics because I was having symptoms of an infection after about a week. And I did have an infection. It was not, luckily it was not an STI, but it was just from all of the physical trauma that had happened. So it was a long road to actually, to physically healing myself. I still struggle with muscle contractions down there actually, where I can't control those muscle contractions. My body will seize. So for a while I couldn't put tampons in because my body would physically not allow anything in that space. And so after those couple days and going back and forth to the wellness center, I think that's what really made it real and also actually really helped my journey because those women who worked there never once questioned me. They just wanted to make sure I was okay.
Mm-hmm. That's so powerful that they didn't, they were so supportive. Was there anything they said, you know, that was particularly helpful in your mind, Maeve?
It wasn't as much about what they said. It was that they never broke eye contact with me. They looked me in the eye and said, "We know this terrible thing happened to you and we're so sorry. We're sorry that we couldn't prevent it. We're sorry that other people couldn't prevent it. We're sorry that you couldn't prevent it." And it was in the way that she, the particular nurse practitioner who I was working with, touched my body. She would tell me every single thing she was going to do. And she would ask for my consent each time, even if it was the smallest thing, like moving my foot. She would say, "May I move your foot?"
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. That is brilliant. Do you want to talk at all, Maeve, about the other, you referenced something had happened to you before. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I can talk about that. So when I was 14, my first boyfriend raped me, and he raped me in my house. My dad actually came home in the middle of it, and he did not know for 6.5 years that what had been happening to me. He walked in on me, basically. It was extremely embarrassing, to say the least. And he did not know for 6.5 years that what was happening to me was against my will, because he basically walks upstairs. I'm scrambling to get out from under this person who's also scrambling to get his clothes on because no one wants to be caught by the parent. And my dad thinks that at 14, I'm having sex with my boyfriend and he's so ashamed of me.
Oh,
or at least it felt at that point that he was really ashamed of me.
Did he say anything about it?
He asked me to come upstairs to our third floor, basically to have a conversation with me. And it was so embarrassing for me. I felt so much shame and I internalized that shame. And he had no intention of shaming me. I think he was just as disturbed that his 14-year-old daughter was having any sexual interaction with anyone at all. He just didn't know that what was happening or what had happened, that he'd interrupted something that was actually very painful for me. And in many ways, he saved me. But the shame of that moment was it lived on for sure. And I just stopped talking. I really fell into myself. I stopped investing in relationships. I developed a terrible eating disorder that almost killed me. And then finally, 6.5 years later, I told my parents. And both of them were as supportive as they possibly could be. It was amazing. But unfortunately, in that interim, when I was a late teen, I was raped again. And it was intimate partner violence. And I just didn't know what to do anymore. I was like, how can this possibly keep happening to me? How can I be laying here and someone doing something to my body when I have expressly said, I do not want this. Please stop. And unable to physically remove myself from the situation. And so I realized when this past experience happened, the most recent one, that I was going to tell someone immediately, because not telling someone never served me. It only hurt me more. But by telling someone, I was changing my thought process about what had happened. And I was expediting my journey towards being the person that I wanted to be. And that is someone who is comfortable being intimate with people, who enjoys going out with her friends, who prioritizes relationships with others, but most of all, loves her own body. And that's what I struggled with for so long, was my relationship to my own body.
Wow.
So Maeve, that you talked about your relationship to your body, was that changing prior to the last incident, or was it that last incident that really sparked that exploration on your part?
It was the most recent incident. My most recent rape was the catalyst for changing how I viewed myself, because I really wasn't sure how I was going to survive it this time if I didn't change the image I had of who I was.
Well, Maeve, yeah. Do you think the running, I'm going back to the running.
Yeah.
The running has helped you physically become more united back with your body and all the eating issues? And
yeah.
And I guess maybe I have another question about the eating and the, did it feel like you went in that place because I was ashamed of my body? I mean, just, this is not multiple choice, but I'm thinking, is it, I don't like my body. I don't like the skin I'm in.
I think it was about disappearing.
Disappearing.
Like, I this, wanted to disappear.
That's okay. So disappear, become thin, or disappear like I would be better off in a hospital if I didn't have to, you know, how extreme was it? What does disappear mean?
I think I was looking for a physical manifestation of my grief, a physical manifestation of my trauma. So what had happened to me physically, you couldn't see it the way that you see someone after a bad car crash. The bruises, the broken bones, it's very visible. And in this case, this thing that had happened to my body really wasn't visible to most people. And it was not intentional to try and make it visible, but I think I was trying to ask for help and I just didn't know how to, because I also at this point really hadn't learned a lot about consent. And I didn't really know what that looked like. And it wasn't until high school that I had my sex ed teacher, actually was the one who really showed me that consent is a very complex thing, and that it is okay if halfway through something I don't like it anymore, I can say, nope, not for me, I want to go. And so my eating disorder was a way for me to disappear into myself. It was a way to make me feel as if also men would not want my body. So in my head at least, the more kid-like I look, the more that I look as if I am sick and infertile, men who I was viewing as predatory, even though some of the most incredible people in my life are men, they wouldn't want me, they wouldn't see me, and I just didn't want to be seen. I wore, you know, lots of sweatpants and sweatshirts, and not eating helped me get there. And it was also a control thing. If I felt like I was out of control with my body, well, I can control what goes in my body. And if I don't have a lot of respect for my body, one of the versions of self-harm that I used was to starve it. But running's different. Running's a way of making me feel strong. I'm never running from my problems. I'm running straight into them and through them.
That's beautifully said, Maeve. I love your fortitude and vision and how you describe the long distance, you know, persistence. So when you're running, are you going back through your head and replaying the events? Are you thinking about, like, what's happening in your head now when you're running? Because that's maybe your own mental therapy with your own self.
Yeah, absolutely. When I run, I think about those people and what they have. I don't want to say what they've given me because that gives them credit and they don't deserve credit. But when they tried to take everything they could, I lived on and I gained actually so much. I feel like I gained this perspective on myself and on the world that I would never have had. And in many ways, I see that as a blessing, which isn't to say I'm happy these things happened, but I'm choosing to get out of them every ounce of knowledge that I can. And I'm able to do that when I'm running because I'm focusing on the rhythm of my feet moving, of my breath. And it is a way for me to manage my PTSD, which I do have. I see frequently when I run, I see things that are not there. I see this man who is not there, who did these terrible things to me. And it's not like he's standing right in front of me, but it's like in this periphery of my vision, I'm seeing these ghosts of people who tried to take everything I had, and I'm faster than them. And that's, I think, why when I'm running, I'm working through that manifestation of my trauma. I also look for details in those experiences because I find that my memory has changed a lot. My ability to remember things since I've had these traumatic experiences, I have a much harder time remembering anything that's not super positive. Even if it's a bad conversation I had with someone, it's like I instantly try and block it out. And if someone asked me, well, what did we talk about? I couldn't tell you what we talked about. And so when I'm running, I think, you know, these things will come into my mind, these images, recovered images will come into my mind. And instead of trying to will them away, I see them and I just let them pass. And every time I do that, I'm training myself to sit better with my trauma because it's never going to leave me. I got to live with it for the rest of my life. So I need to be comfortable with it and not see it as a villain in my mind.
Claire, what are you thinking we should talk to Maeve about toward the end of our discussion?
Well, since it's so recent, and this is something that happened, well, it happened in college, but it wasn't a college student who did this.
Yes, but no, it was not a college
classic
student.
It's sort of a, it's I think, you know, Tinder, that sort of the milieu of Tinder, that kind of thing is something that a lot of young people interact with it and other dating apps. I wonder if you have any thoughts to share, wisdom to share regarding that world, which is a world that Katie and I didn't have to deal with. But I so feel for young adults now who are, you know, embarking on their lives, and this is how people meet, you know, and I'm just, what thoughts do you have about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important thing is that while so many terrible things can happen with platforms like Tinder, it doesn't mean we should not use them. In fact, I think it's a disservice to yourself to say, I'm never going to use these things, because other people are using them. And it's part of our generation. It's part of the reality of our generation. And having your security mechanisms in place is the most important thing. It is not your fault if you meet someone on Tinder and they hurt you. It is never your fault because you go into that with good intentions. Choosing to be outgoing and meet new people is never a bad thing. It doesn't mean that it doesn't come with harm or it can't be threatening. But by choosing to be around other humans, I mean, being around other people is one of the greatest gifts of life. So if you are going to be on Tinder, knowing other people in your area who are near you, wherever you're going, that's important. Telling someone where you're going, sharing a location with a close friend. Never, ever, ever, I think this is the biggest one, I don't believe anyone should ever invite someone they do not know and have never met before to their private space. And that might seem obvious to a lot of people, but anyone who hasn't been on Tinder doesn't realize the feeling of needing to please that comes with meeting someone for the first time. And I think this might be particularly true for women, but you never have to let someone in your room if you don't want to, even if it offends them. So what if it offends them? If it offends them, that is information to you that you don't want them there to begin with.
Wise words, wise words. And I think, if I may add, listen to your gut, right? If your instinct tells you something's alarming, pay attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah, beautiful interview, Maeve. I'm so glad we had the chance to invite you to the podcast and share your strength and your healing process. It's been literally miles to go and more of your journey. So, Claire, is there anything else you can think we should talk about?
I think we've covered a lot. I really appreciate it, Mary. This has been great.
Thank you so much. I really valued this time together.
Yeah, you were amazingly powerful. Mm-hmm. So Maeve, anything else you want to share with our listeners about their healing process?
Maybe the last thing I would say is that I think that we think of our trauma as something to get rid of. And I love the idea of treating your body like a palimpsest, which for anyone who doesn't know, is basically when you look at ancient manuscripts, there's layers of writing, and then there's layers of other writing because it was really expensive to produce vellum and parchment. And we love looking at those old artifacts, and we put them in museums, we put them on display for people to see, we celebrate them. Some of the greatest works of art are actually palimpsests. But we don't think of our bodies that way. But everything that happens to your body, well, it's part of your story, and then we write over it with a new story. But instead of trying to obscure the worst stories that we have to carry, I think it's better to see them as a part of your human canvas. All of us are working pieces of art. We're in progress, and we have these scars, and no one escapes life unscathed. And that is okay, because that means that we've lived and that we are living and will continue to do so. And I think seeing trauma as something that you can turn into a positive, as something that you can carry with pride, is one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves.
So gorgeous. Thank you, Maeve.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So Claire, can you close our podcast?
Absolutely. So again, thanks, Maeve, for sharing your story and your hard-earned wisdom with us. And thank you also to all our amazing and wonderful volunteers who make this podcast possible. And thank you also to all of you who are listeners, who are bearing witness to Maeve's story and who are learning from her as well. Help us help other survivors by sharing this podcast with people you know, and put it on your social media and let other folks know about it. Follow us on our Facebook page and our Instagram pages. That will help get the word out. If you need support but don't know where to find it, if you visit takebackthenight.org, there you will find a list of resources and also a way to contact our legal support hotline. And bottom line is, of course, remembering that self-care is essential to healing and thriving.
Thank you so much, Claire. And again, thank you for joining us, Maeve, and for all of our listeners. Again, this is another episode, one more step toward that healing process that all of us need. And if you're a supporter, Maeve also gave tons of great tips with, I go back to the nurses, like asking if they can touch your feet. So, you know, I think permission and respect is so important in life. And it takes courage to ask someone permission, but it takes mostly respect. So thank you, listeners. Come back to another episode and take good care. Bye.
So long, everyone. Bye.
Thank you again, everybody, for joining another episode of the Dear Katie podcast. I hope very much you found today's episode helpful, empowering, and a way to take another step in that long journey toward healing and supporting those we care about, learning about sexual violence prevention, and also survivor support. For those of you who don't know, again, the Take Back the Night website has tons of great resources, books, self-care options, cool merch. If you're feeling like you need a wearable, we have great t-shirts. Of course, we would love it if you follow along on our free newsletter with news and events going on around the country and even around the globe. And finally, don't forget to like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find our entire community popping up here and there, and recaps of our podcast episodes as well. So together we shatter the silence, and together we end the violence. Take care.